Hello, and welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast, where we look at the latest news, analysis, and research on China's growing presence in the developing world. I'm your host, Eric Mike Serino, coming to you today from Durham, North Carolina. And I know it's been a while since our last episode. In our last episode, we spoke about Chinese infrastructure investment in Mozambique and its effects, or lack thereof, on backwards linkages in the broader Mozambican economy. So on this episode, we're going to continue with a country-specific focus, Myanmar. Specifically, we're going to look at Chinese investment in Myanmar and its potential for, or to the challenges thereof, of delivering sustainable development in the country. And we couldn't have a better guest to talk about the subject than Nicholas Low. Nick is a master's student at Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, and he recently wrote a piece for the Beijing-based nonprofit, the Global Environmental Institute, entitled Challenges to Greening the Belt and Road, a Case Study of Myanmar. He wrote this during his research fellowship with GEI for his master's thesis, which he focuses on Chinese overseas investment in Myanmar through an anthropological and geographic lens. Hey, welcome to the show, Nick.
Thanks so much for having me, Eric. It's really great to have people looking at the Belt and Road.
Yeah, and you know, thank you so much for your work in the sense of being able to dig really deep into one country and seeing how the Belt and Road actually gets implemented on the ground. First, I just want to talk about GEI, this Beijing-based nonprofit that you worked over the summer. Can you just give a little brief overview of the work that they do and the work that you did with them?
Okay, so Global Environment Institute is one of the most internationally oriented and outward-facing Chinese environmental NGOs, and it's really successfully established itself as a sort of liaison between the international environmental and sort of NGO community and what's going on inside China. They have a range of different programs, including conservation, monitoring overseas investment and trade, looking at like sort of low carbon economic planning and other sorts of all sorts of environmental issues. So they're a pretty diverse group of people, and they've actually begun to sort of expand their operations in Myanmar by sort of partnering with these Burmese forestry group, and they're sort of hoping to scale up their community conservation projects to serve as a sort of pilot, I guess, for future efforts by other Chinese NGOs or for other development initiatives that are supported by the newly established State International Development Cooperation Agency, whatever the name is.
Yeah, I always forget it as well. Yeah.
So they also previously have worked and are currently working on timber trade regulations because the illicit timber trade between China and Myanmar is and has been and continues to be a really big deal. In terms of my research fellowship with GEI, so I had received funding from Yale to conduct my summer research. And GEI, because of their sort of positioning as both like experts on China's overseas investments and also the sort of development finance ecosystem within China that is largely really opaque to Western observers, because I don't know, it's like pretty arcane. There are a lot of like subsidiaries, a lot of bureaucratic processes, loan approval procedures with the China Exim Bank and things like that, that if you weren't in China, it'd be pretty hard to become familiar with. And so a lot of different environmental groups like Conservation International or other sort of more broad-based NGO groups like Oxfam have worked with GEI on a range of different initiatives. And so I think it's really interesting. For me, working with them was perfect because it gave me insight into sort of understanding how the Chinese government promoting Chinese NGOs to go out, similar to like the other businesses that have gone out as part of the Zhou Chu campaign of the 2000s. Yeah, so Chinese NGOs are supposed to now go out to other countries as well along the Belt and Road Initiative to help gather information or cooperate with local partners in terms of like resolving environmental issues.
Yeah, you know, some of GEI's work that I've read, I became familiar with their Go Global series, and some of the best work I've seen about Chinese firms, Chinese financing of potential sustainable development initiatives throughout. It was before the Belt and Road, it was during the Go Global, and now they've kind kind of adopted a green BRI position as well. So it's a fascinating organization. I highly recommend anyone to check it out, all of their work. But let's get back to the point of Europe-specific research on Chinese investment in Myanmar.
Can you give our listeners a brief overview of modern Chinese involvement in Myanmar?
So that really begins in the sort of post-World War II era when Myanmar has recently become independent and China has recently been consolidated under the Mao Zedong. And Burma is, at the time, the military government is fighting against the ethnic separatist movements that come about because of the sort of tensions between the majority Burmans and then other groups like the Karen or Kachin. And so there's been civil war in Burma since 1947, 1948. And in the 1960s, there's a military coup that overthrows the central government in Burma at the time, and that leads to a lot of communal violence against ethnic Chinese and other South Asians in Yangon. And that leads to the sort of Chinese Communist Party supporting the rise of the Communist Party of Burma, giving them arms and training and other sorts of like funding material support for a long time. And this is sort of part of China's revolutionary foreign policy during the 60s and the 70s. Eventually, due to sort of shifts in both China and Burma, eventually the Communist Party of Burma collapses in 1989 with a mutiny led by soldiers within the Communist Party of Burma, and it sort of splits up. And in the 90s, this sort of leads to a longer story that I'll sure we'll get into later. But in the 90s, the sort of first wave of Chinese, major wave of Chinese investment in Burma comes from international sanctions that were placed on the Burmese military regime in the aftermath of the crackdown of the 1988 Students' Democracy Movement. And so then the government really turns to China for arms and development financing and things like that. And in the 2000s, the Chinese government is also beginning its Open Up the West campaign, or Xi Bu Da Kai Fa. And so sort of trade, investment, and large-scale infrastructure really starts to become important for Yunnan province. And that really starts to pick up as the Chinese government is trying to push its companies to create connections in other countries to expand the trade networks and sort of open up markets for Chinese products. And so there's been a lot of private investment also coming from Yunnan and all sorts of businesses. And that, I think, is a sort of under-examined aspect of Chinese foreign investment because it is often private. It's like stuff in the import-export trade. You have people funding like illegal logging gangs or being involved in jade mining, agribusiness plantations of all kinds, or even the domestic construction industry within Myanmar.
I know data could be very difficult or almost impossible to get in this type of region, but are there estimates of, numbers of project number or dollar amount of trade that's gone in or investment that's gone in either on the state side or the private side?
I can't really tell you off the top of my head, but China is Myanmar's largest trading partner. And just recently, there were some border trading zones that were inked in paper, I guess, on the China-Myanmar border in the north in Kachin State and Shan State. And so you really see the Chinese government gearing up for just increasing this volume of trade, which has already rapidly increased since Myanmar's economy has sort of liberalized in recent years.
Yeah. And so, and your research focuses on natural resource investment, natural resource extraction investment. In your piece, you speak about the legacy of inequality that exists of who benefits from Myanmar's natural resource investments. Can you go into that?
I could go back a little bit and speak a little bit more about the ways in which Chinese infrastructure investment has really sort of come to the fore in the sort of late 2000s. And I think this is sort of a part of a larger story where The military regime in Myanmar is sort of preparing for a transition to civilian rule in the aftermath, the sort of Saffron Revolution in 2007, where a lot of monks came out and protested, and also Cyclone Nargis in 2008, which devastated large parts of Myanmar and kind of opened up the door for international aid and other forms of sort of international institutions, NGOs to come in and establish a presence. And so after the transition to civilian rule, a lot of MOUs have already been sort of signed between China and the Myanmar military government, including the sort of Myitsone Dam, which is actually the part of a series of dams on the Irrawaddy River and its sort of tributaries. And so that's sort of the most famous or infamous case, where the sort of $3.6 billion project was suspended. And I emphasize that it was suspended and not canceled, because that's a very big difference there. Over 10,000, 15,000 people have already been resettled and relocated from the Myitsone Reservoir area. But now that in late, I think, 2011, the President Thein Sein of Myanmar, responding to sort of public pressure and the opening, there were like widespread protests all across the country. And there was this geopolitical opening where he could sort of gain international human rights points by responding to the public pressure, and also sort of distancing himself from Chinese influence, which the sort of Burmese generals have always been really wary of because of their dependence on Chinese funds and supplies and equipment. And there are also other, there's a series of other dams on the Salween River, which is known as the Thanluin River in Myanmar or the Nujiang in China. And this has always been hard for me to understand, because the Nujiang just flows directly into and turns into the Salween. And sort of like, despite the designation of the sort of Nujiang Grand Canyon National Park upstream in China, and the sort of suspension of those dam plans there, the ones in on the Myanmar side of the border in Shan State and Karen State, those are still live. Not much work has been able to progress on them, but due to sort of armed conflict around the dam sites, mm-hmm. as well as widespread local opposition. But the plans are still just kind of sitting in limbo. And there are a lot of other signature sort of projects, include the oil and gas pipelines, which costs sort of $2.5 billion mm-hmm. to construct, that all across from the western coast of Myanmar and Rakhine State, and crossing all the way through the middle and Shan State and across the Chinese border into a refinery near Kunming, which was actually the target of Kunming citizens' sort of anti-PX protests in 2013.
Oh, really?
Actually. Yeah, it's the same plant, the Anning plant, is connected all the way to Myanmar.
I did not know that. Yeah, because I remember that story from 2013 of the protests that happened in Kunming. And interesting.
Yeah, and so that pipeline finally started running in 2017, and that kind of resolves China's Malacca dilemma, where the whole Straits of Malacca are kind of like a geostrategic choke point. Da, da, da.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard though that pipeline has not been running as much as capacity as what they were expecting or planned, and there's been security issues throughout it. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's been delays, I think, both in terms of construction, just like, I mean, prior to the like completion of the pipeline itself, there were armed clashes in northern Shan State near the Chinese border around the pipeline. And so, like, this is it's difficult terrain. It's like the sort of mountainous, montane, dry forests of sort of like upland Southeast Asia and like Yunnan and it's hard terrain to get through and to like construct stuff in. And so, yeah, a lot of these infrastructure projects do end up running overboard on costs and have major delays.
And so how do these major infrastructure projects, as dams, roads, pipelines, how do they impact the natural resource investment, natural resource extraction that happens either by state players or private players on the from China?
The ways in which infrastructure development sort of facilitates natural resource extraction is not really well understood in this rigorous, geographically quantified way. But you definitely can draw the conclusion that with the sort of expansion, this sort of research has been like done all over the world. It's just that the expansion of road networks, highways, and you can imagine that like the establishment of like industrial zones and more processing and manufacturing centers in a like primarily agrarian landscape will end up sort of accelerating the processes of extraction by just sort of facilitating a like smoother like passage of goods or raw materials from Myanmar to China. You can already sort of see that in the expansion of roads and the spread of like deforestation in northern Myanmar. After the logging ban in China in the 90s, in the late 90s, manufacturers really turned to Southeast Asia to supply raw timber. And that has been a huge problem in Myanmar. I think in 2015 or something, a few years ago, about like 150 illegal loggers were caught by the Myanmar Forestry Department and were jailed. But then these were Chinese people who came from Yunnan. They're like sort of like poor laborers who are sort of hired to go and cross the border illegally and harvest valuable timber. Just a few days later, all 150 of them were like pardoned and allowed to return to China. This caused a kind of big uproar in Myanmar among the public because it was a sign of clear influence over the Myanmar government. And at the same time, you also don't want to like blame these loggers who are actually just being paid by their bosses in Kunming or even further afield who are sort of procuring this supply for like luxury buyers.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing, especially what you've noted a few times here, is the importance of provinces within the Belt and Road Initiative. I mean, and where the line blurs of what was go global or what was you expand to the West and then now go global, now it's Belt and Road. Whatever it is of how decentralized sometimes the decision-making process is of how these initiatives get put out on the ground. And so can you speak a little bit more about the importance of specifically Yunnan and provincial decision-makers in China and provincial actors on this infrastructure investment and natural resource extraction investment in Myanmar?
I can't like say definitively about the sort of direct like links between specific individuals in Yunnan and the sort of infrastructure development initiatives in Myanmar, but I can tell you that, yeah, Yunnan's companies, a lot of them are the sort of provincial SOEs, and so they sort of encounter like lower regulatory barriers as compared to like the national level SOEs in China when it comes to participating in different sorts of development projects. And so you see the involvement of lots of the like Yunnan export import machinery company and like all sorts of a lot of those kinds of companies that are operating and like constructing roads and people. The signs of sort of Chinese development are kind of mundane in a way. It's just like, yeah, the roads are now smoother in, say, Sagaing region or Kachin state because the Chinese companies have been contracted and they're the best at laying roads in record time. So, and it creates like it really facilitates the integration of previously remote areas in Myanmar's highlands, which have been like subjected to war and displacement and unregulated extraction in this ceasefire war chaos. And so roads and expressways and the sort of upgrading of railroads, they're all sort of being rolled out as part of the China-Myanmar Economic Corridor, an MOU for which was just signed a few months ago. And the feasibility studies for like road and railway upgrades are moving full steam ahead. And yeah, so despite the setbacks that China has encountered, or at least its companies have encountered in Myanmar, in like the sort of shrinking of the Zhaopiu special economic zone, sort of project size from around $7 billion to less than $2 billion out of fear of the debt trap, the conflicts around the hydropower dams, and the sort of, yeah, like Myitsone Dam was the suspension decision, which was unilateral on the Myanmar government's part, was like a real slap in the face for the Chinese government. I think that these big infrastructure projects, like these mega dams and stuff, are sort of lightning rods for attention and are conducive for sort of public opposition to coalesce around. But the smaller projects are like really have like really localized impacts that are hard to really it's hard for people to get the attention of the international world when you're just like one small village that's being affected by like a coal-fired power plant right next door. Like that's happening everywhere in China. And so a Chinese-run coal-fired power plant in Myanmar isn't going to get much attention.
Can you give an example of one of these smaller projects you are talking about and its effects on the ground?
So just this summer, I went to this town nearby Inlay Lake, which is this really famous tourism destination in Myanmar. It's like a beautiful, huge lake where there are fishermen, like, I don't know, riding their sort of traditional rafts and like people doing floating gardens and farming and all sorts of traditional crafts. And it's a really beautiful place. But just 13 kilometers away, there's this coal-fired power plant that is... So it's a pretty complicated story. It's located essentially in the territory of a former armed resistance group that signed a ceasefire with the Myanmar military and then sort of became a sort of proxy militia. There's a coal mine that was started there, and it was established to feed this coal-fired power plant, which was built in 2001 and sort of operated by China National Heavy Machinery Corporation. And this thing was just like a really low-tech coal-fired power plant. Fly ash was just spewing out into the air, landing on people's farms and polluting the water. And so there were a lot of health issues that were coming out of this. And people were telling me that for a while, like the local nurse at the clinic was sort of telling her superiors about this and was like complaining about the health impacts of this coal-fired power plant and coal mine, which are like right next to each other and just like right next to this village. And eventually she stopped talking about that kind of stuff because of pressure from above. And yeah, the power plant was actually shut down in 2014 due to the sort of environmental pollution concerns, which were really egregious. But then this new company, Wuxi Huagang Engineering, took over in 2015 to sort of re-upgrade the plant, and they've restarted operations since May 2017. And the villagers I talked to around there were telling me that even though that the sort of they've installed a sort of scrubber to prevent fly ash from being emitted, like their livestock are still getting sick, their crops aren't growing as well. People are still getting sick. They never get a chance to talk to the sort of Chinese company managers who run the power plant. And so from their perspective, things really haven't changed, even though there may environmental quality wise, things have improved, like the sort of relationship between the community and this power plant are still really tense and just opaque. And there really isn't any sort of chance for the community members to voice their concerns or communicate in any way to the company. And I think this sort of case is replicated throughout the country, where there's sort of no real sense of being heard or having participated in any decision-making processes about these big development projects. And this power plant is probably only, I think it's over 100 megawatts, but compared to other ones, it's not such a big one. But it still has like these major impacts on people's livelihoods.
Yeah, and it's not a big enough thing that it's going to be international flashpoint like the Meson Dam, and mm-hmm. I think you know your piece covered it really well in the sense of like can China, the challenges of creating a green BRI, and I think one of the challenges many people have pointed out is that so many of these projects, especially the higher level ones and even the smaller ones, Chinese firms typically work with those who are in the heads of state. And there's very limited, if any, engagement with local stakeholders. And so especially when you have something that as big of an impact as a hydroelectric dam or a pipeline or a coal plant next door, and you're not able to understand the political and social risks on the ground because there's no interaction between the two. I guess, can you comment a little bit about that? And, is there a case that you've seen of a Chinese firm doing at least somewhat better in that regards? Or is there a lot of work to do, a lot of work to go?
It's really this question of how the whole idea of a green Belt and Road initiative holds up against reality on the ground. What was kind of funny to me is like in the promotional materials of the Chinese company that runs the sort of Trans-Myanmar pipelines, and they were saying that the construction of the natural gas pipeline was done in an eco-friendly manner that would contribute towards green development. And like from the perspective of someone who's sort of trained in the environmental sciences, environmental studies, it's just like, there's no way that natural gas development could ever be considered green by any measure. It's like methane is like one of the most intensive greenhouse gases that there is.
Possibly be of having a green natural gas pipeline.
Yeah, right. But like that's the way things are branded. And so I think it's really important to really interrogate the ways in which green is being just sort of thrown around these days. Like the whole idea of there being sort of win-win situations created, I think only holds up if you're talking about like the Myanmar and Chinese governments, really. Like with many investments all around the country, many of which do involve Chinese capital, like the main issues are like land and conflict. And there's so many like small to medium scale investments in mining, logging, or like agribusiness that are like not really trackable, really, and are like kind of unknown to the Chinese government regulators. And like it's the sort of provincial office in Kunming that is like sort of, they are encouraged to sort of promote outbound investment from their offices. And so that sort of facilitates this, it's kind of like land grabbing. And there's a recent case where villagers' farms in Kachin State are being appropriated just for banana plantations. And the private Chinese entrepreneurs from Yunnan are doing this with the help of the local militia. And it's sort of like this mundane aspect of the Belt and Road Initiative and the sort of establishment of like new production systems that are really rapidly transforming the economic landscape and with really major consequences for communities and the environment. And that article that I wrote was really a roundabout way of saying that Chinese investment capital is often implicated one way or another, directly or indirectly considered perpetuating environmental degradation or forced displacement and dispossession. And these are really intimately tied to the ways in which the extractive sectors are profitable in Myanmar. It's because of like lack of regulation. I do realize that for the sort of Chinese companies, whether they are state-owned enterprises at the central level who are investing in really large-scale development projects, or whether it's like a smaller mining company or something like that, the domestic regulatory environment in Myanmar is really a mess in terms of environmental impact assessments and those sorts of safeguards. I think people often forget that Myanmar only transitioned to civilian rule in like 2011 and only has been, as a sort of country that has recently opened up its political system, like what can you really expect when they're like to expect good governance from a place that has been run by like a military regime for the past 70 years and has also been like in this permanent state of like militarization. Like it's hard to imagine that there would be any sort of effective environmental regulation at all.
So if that's going to happen, it's going to have to happen on the investor side of it. And thus far, there's been limited ability or...
I would say that, it's like often there's this sort of like what if or what about argument that comes with criticisms of Chinese investments in other countries. And it is true that like, China is not the only investor in Myanmar, though it is the dominant one. Thailand, Japan, Malaysia, Singapore, all significant investors in Myanmar too. But I think there's just specific dimension to Chinese investment. And like so a lot of Chinese observers are correct to point out that like, China is being singled out. Whether that's fair or unfair is up for other people to decide. But it's the size and scale of Chinese investment in Myanmar and the speed at which it's coming in that's significant to people. And also the history of Chinese investment in Myanmar that is not being recognized too much in media accounts, both in the West and in China. There's a sort of relationship between like foreign investment capital and domestic politics that's not being unpacked. What is Chinese investment capital allowing the Myanmar military to do? Is it like consolidating territory with that capital? There are like several problems that I really see with that I think are applicable to Chinese investments in other countries as well. For one, there's a sort of double bind on the Chinese government's side, sort of overseas and investment safeguards and regulations. They're just voluntary guidelines. In the host government, and often in many countries, there's sort of no incentive to improve governance if the investment capital is going to flow in regardless. And so that's the sort of link that doesn't, that goes kind of unexamined. The other problem is sort of understanding the local context and politics and how Chinese companies as actors with a lot of capital and influence in that regard fit into that world. And there's this sort of sense of paternalism and exhibited by these Chinese companies in relation to the communities that are affected by these projects. It's like they're assuming that electrification, modernization is what people want, when what the vast majority of people want in these parts of Myanmar, where these development projects are sort of slated to take place, is like they want peace. And there's this really sort of strong assumption that I see on the part of Chinese company managers or like state propaganda that this local Kachin and Shan people should just sort of move aside and take the money and like compensation. But sort of land means more than money to people, and it really discounts the pain and legacy of war and the role that China has historically played in exacerbating that. Going back to what I had brought up earlier about the sort of Chinese support for the Communist Party of Burma, like the Chinese government is provided through a lifeline for the Myanmar military regime in the 90s. And Myanmar's citizens like remember that all over the country. And the Chinese government provided arms and military equipment to the regime, which then used it against its own citizens. Today, as Myanmar emerges into this semi-democratic transition, China's playing a really active role in the peace process, despite its policy of non-interference. It's encouraging one of the groups that split off from the Communist Party of Burma, the United Wa State Army, which is just the same Wazu as the groups in Yunnan. This Wa State Army is this semi-independent state in Myanmar, which is one of like the most powerful armed groups. It has like 30,000 soldiers. And they actually, in that area, they have their own gun factories, they speak Chinese, have received Chinese training, and they use RMB for everything. Yes, it's a fascinating thing that is also a really inaccessible region. But China has really encouraged them to take a leading role in forming a coalition of armed groups to negotiate with the Myanmar government. And another one of these armed groups is the Myanmar National Democratic Alliance Army in the Kokang region of Guogan. Yeah, so the ethnic Han Chinese group that originated also as part of the Communist Party of Burma. And their leader, Peng Jiasheng, he hides out in China. And they are currently at war with the Myanmar military, with the Kachin Independence Army as the Northern Alliance. And so this like really convoluted story, the main takeaway from this super convoluted story is that China has a lot of influence over these armed resistance groups in the border that are at war with the Myanmar military. And China also has a lot of influence with the Myanmar government, despite its sort of earlier setbacks. And so it's just that
towards what type of end?
That's the thing. It's like, towards what type of end? And that's the question that people all across Myanmar, like from all sorts of different ethnic groups, are sort of asking. It's like, what is China really, or what is the Chinese government, and what are those companies really pushing, you know? And I think they're right to sort of suspect the kind of loss of autonomy that comes with the industrialization and the sort of creation of a particular economic system that's based on, say like factory labor, in terms of like establishing special economic zones or processing zones, like what we see in like Cambodia and other countries that are established by sort of like Chinese consortiums and things like that. And so, I mean, I don't want to paint like an overly gloomy picture, but like you can't walk into, coming from the Chinese company's perspective, you can't walk into ongoing civil war and like expect things to go smoothly.
Yeah. And
like all these different kinds of businesses are like kind of tied to bloodshed and violence in some way. It's like sort of blood trade, you know? That's why there is such like great anti-Chinese public sentiment in Myanmar. One, the association with the military regime, and two, like ongoing disputes over land, which are also a legacy of military rule. Three, the apparent sort of disregard and lack of consideration on the Chinese company's part for Burmese people's views. And so those three things kind of come together and make it really difficult for Chinese investment to get to, like, I don't know, exert a positive soft power.
That's a great place to end our conversation. It's somber, but it's certainly a message when so many of the Belt and Road countries are lower on the governance level. They have, not only in Myanmar, I mean, Pakistan has lots of security issues, internal domestic strife. And when a Chinese firm, when Chinese money goes in, that's going to have an effect on the local domestic political situation and on ways in which, especially outside observers who don't have in-depth knowledge of Myanmar or Pakistan or what's happening on the internal domestic politics side of it, know from the outside. Mm-hmm. But certainly those, the locals who, when there isn't a voice, it can definitely upend a lot of resentment towards these projects and any type of soft power, political ends in which China wishes to gain from building this infrastructure will definitely not happen because of that.
Yeah, and just, there are a lot of like amazing people in Myanmar who are fighting good fight that I've learned like so much from, and their sort of ongoing struggles for justice and their humor and kindness in the face of trauma and displacement really inspire me. And I think that there is a lot that the Myanmar people of all sort of nationalities and the people of China of different ethnicities also kind of share. There's the space and like opportunity for really amazing collaboration under sort of really restrictive political circumstances.
Certainly. And do you have an example or examples of that, or just?
But yeah, there are like sort of connections being made between activists who fight both for the environment and sort of community rights, both in China and Myanmar, who are sort of sharing knowledge about how to resist this destructive development and to articulate a sort of more equitable and more just vision of the future.
Well, that's a much higher note to end our podcast on.
But before we go, we like to do recommendations. Do you have a recommendation for our listeners?
There's this interesting anthropology article that came out recently by Naoko Kumada at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. It's called Margin to Mainstream, Periphery to Center, Geopolitics and the Anthropology of Burma and the Silk Roads. And it's sort of about like, it gives like a kind of historical cultural overview of how, yeah, this whole new Silk Roads sort of discourse fits into Burma and or Myanmar's contemporary geopolitics today. And I think it just, I don't know, it provides that sort of historical backdrop that we often don't pay enough attention to.
That sounds great. I would love to read that. I certainly will. Yeah, the historical ties are something I find tend to be missing, especially on more popular pieces about the Belt and Road. Where, you know, the Belt and Road started now, and then talk about the Meystone Dam, which started in mid-2000s, what have you. And then whatever however that started with those firms happened because of whatever, you know, the history of China entering in the 90s because of the sanctions placed upon the Myanmar military government. And so there's just so much more context that needs to be sussed out for all these bilateral relations.
And like for every single country, you know, and that's not even getting into like the sort of porous borders of so many of these places.
Thank you for that recommendation. My recommendation for this week is Power Asymmetry and Threat Points, Negotiating China's Infrastructure Development in Southeast Asia. It's in the latest review of International Political Economy. It's by Yun Ao. It's just a great look at the negotiating abilities in power imbalances from four Southeast Asian countries in negotiating the contract terms for the high-speed railroad, Chinese-invested high-speed railroads in Myanmar, Thailand, Laos, and Indonesia. And I just found it really interesting. So I'll put that in the show notes as well.
After recording, Nick wanted to give us a second recommendation, more on the political factors of China's support for the Communist Party in Burma that were not explained within the podcast. But he wants would love everyone to read the comprehensive book by Martin Smith, entitled Burma Insurgency and the Politics of Ethnicity. So definitely go and check that out as well.
Well, again, you've been listening to the Belt and Road podcast. Nick, thank you again for coming on, and thanks again for listening.
Yeah, thanks so much, Eric. Really appreciate you having me.